Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
You know, flying down, as I say, the Carpathian Mountains were amazing. Just that snow-capped mountains one side, and we were weaving in and out, following that river, and they, with them formating around me and flying with me and me waving at them, that was just, I just relive that a lot of the time, and it just beautiful. And I think that was really one of them. The other one was, of course, just going over the channel.
Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and returning to Extended is Amanda Harrison. Of course, Amanda featured in our Women in Aviation series, that of course was episode 96, Ordinary Women Doing Extraordinary Things. And she was also a guest back in episode 37 when we talked about the Tiger Moth and drones. And for those stalwarts still with us from 10 years ago, they'll remember she was my flying instructor when I had my very own biplane experience flying in a Tiger Moth. And for those who haven't listened to it, that's episode 26. So, Amanda, welcome back to Extended.
Thank you very much, Peter, for having me.
Well, it's exciting times, isn't it? A book is just about to come out. A film's just about to come out.
Yeah.
But since we last talked, it's pre-Brexit, it's pre-COVID. The world's changed a lot, of course, and including the world of aviation. But your love for the Tiger Moth hasn't changed at all. Where did this all come from?
Well, the Tiger Moth started when I was learning to fly. And I was actually at an air race and I saw a Tiger Moth and I bounded over to the owner and I said, wow, what is that aeroplane? It's beautiful. And he was very kind and he gave me a little flight in it. And he said two things at the end of it. He said, you've got to learn how to start them because they're hand swung and you've got to learn the history of them. And that's basically where I am. I'm down that rabbit hole and have been down that history rabbit hole ever since. And I just love the look of it. I just thought, yeah, and I read about all these amazing people that had done all these amazing flights in these biplanes and that. So that's where it started.
Yeah. And, it, you know, it's close to my heart. The very first flight I think my dad had when he started his training in World War II was in a Tiger Moth. And that experience that we had was just something unbelievable. You know, obviously having an interest in Tiger Moths was one thing. For those who don't know your career, can you tell us a little bit about how your flying career has evolved?
Well, yes, and it's really strange just to say about your dad with his first flight. So, of course, I'm still flying the Tiger Moth. I'm still giving what they call pleasure flights, so taking people up and showing them like I did with you. And, of course, I used to fly veterans and I used to fly people that knew what the Tiger Moth was all about. Now I'm flying the grandchildren or the great-grandchildren. I'm feeling very old and they don't know what the Tiger Moth's about. But, yeah, my flying career has not done anything that I thought I would have done. I never thought I would be a pilot. Absolutely. I didn't think I was brainy enough or got enough money. So when I was doing my PPL, I just wanted to fly the Tiger and wanted to do tailwheel aeroplanes. So that's what I did. And then I was actually doing my IMC or the IRR and my job just disappeared overnight. So I went into the club all depressed and went, well, I can't, you know, I'm going to have to cancel my lessons. And they said, no, go commercial. And I was kind of like, no, I can't do that. So I am only ever doing the next step. And this is why, truly, people are looking at me now and going, oh, I could never do anything that you could do. But I am only doing the next step. So the next step after my PPL was then to get my medical, then to do the commercial writtens, then to do the commercial flying, then to do the IR, then to do the flight instructor, And somebody said to me, if you want to fly tail draggers a lot and fly the tiger moth a lot, do your flight instructor, because then you'll be able to teach people in the tiger moth, which is very scary when you can't see out the front and there are no brakes and you're careering round the aerodrome on the ground. But that was a very good piece of advice, because I then started teaching people in the tiger moth, and that's how we met, and that's how I really fell in love with it. And that's
right.
And that stayed there. So I've stayed teaching and doing pleasure flights in the tiger moth throughout these past 10, 15 years. And then the commercial side of things is what happened is I trained when it was the first financial crash, so therefore didn't get into the airlines. I got into the holding pools, nothing happened. So I ended up doing charter. Long story short, again, I was just in the next step. I started doing Seneca work at nighttime, which is really tough, which is single pilot. I worked all my way up to a Citation XLS, which is a Ferrari of the charter world. And then I was just about to get my captaincy course and COVID struck. Yay! So all of that disappeared. But in the background is always the tiger moth. So I just went back.
Right. Right. Okay. Just a quick question about flying biz jets, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Any exciting places, any exciting events that you did, or was it shuttle type of work?
It was both. So we did a lot of businessmen back to Switzerland and Germany, day in, day out, for obviously financial stuff. And they were great because they just got in and didn't want any catering, didn't want anything to be there, just got in, got on the laptop and started working. And then you'd get people that were doing all kinds of stuff. So we took a honeymoon couple up to Iceland for the Northern Lights and didn't see a single Northern Light because it was cloudy for the whole time.
Well, stay here, as we've just seen.
Yeah, so we did all kinds of stuff. And I loved that, actually. I really loved it. We did all kinds of different stuff, and down to Tenerife, down to nearly Egypt, all kinds of different things. And I really liked that because it was different day in, day out.
Right, okay. So
I can't tell you who I've flown, you know, because I couldn't tell you that I've flown royalty and politicians and superstars.
Of course you can't. Wow.
Artists and that kind of thing.
Wow. Okay, well, listen, that's a date for another day then, or maybe another book. But let's come back to Solo to Darwin. The book is almost out. The film is almost out. Where did the idea, where's the inspiration come from? Because one of the things I think we've missed is Amy Johnson.
Yes. So again, going back to that very first flight, when I started learning the history about these beautiful aeroplanes, I started learning about all Geoffrey de Havilland, because he was the guy who designed the Tiger Moth, and he was between the world wars. So then I started reading about what his other aeroplanes had done, the Gypsy Moth, the Leopard Moths. And apparently you just walked into Harrods and you just bought your Leopard Moth and you strapped your tennis racket to the side and off you go, darling, and you fly around the world in the very English way that they did. And people would do this, like Sir Alex Henshaw and Lady Mary Heath and Lady Mildred Bruce and this kind of thing. And I thought, aha, so you need to be titled and you need to have lots of money, and therefore I can't do that. So I read all these lovely books and thought, great, marvellous. And then I stumbled across Amy Johnson and I started reading about her. And sometimes I think it's a good thing and sometimes I think it's a bad thing, because I then thought, ooh, she wasn't titled. And she didn't have a lot of money. So maybe, just maybe, you know where I'm going with this guy, maybe I could do it. And it took me 15 years from that, ooh, just maybe, to actually doing it. And I still can't believe I've done it now. And it just, it emerged out of that. I just thought, wow. And I started to do it and I wanted to do it. And then what actually really kicked me over the edge is I had breast cancer and my dad died within the same year. And therefore, those two things, you know, breast cancer trying to kill me and my dad disappearing, who was my inspiration to start flying in the first place. And I thought, life is for living. I've got to do what I want to do. And I threw everything at it to just do it, because life is short and you have to do it.
Right. So what was Amy's journey? What were you trying to do?
I was trying to emulate it. I was never trying to take anything away from Amy. She's amazing. She's my inspiration. She's done, and she did all other records as well. But the Australia trip was the one that I fell in love with, because she just drew a straight line. Bert Hinkler had done down through France and down through Italy. And Amy went, I'm going to beat his 15 days from flying from the UK down to Australia. And she just drew a straight line across the globe and said, that's where I'm going to fly it. And that went through Syria, Iran and Iraq. And I thought, no, that's going to be too scary for me.
Yeah.
So I was only ever going to emulate her trip and try and do it in the best I could. I couldn't afford a Gypsy Moth, which was her aeroplane. So I bought a Tiger Moth, which was the next best one that I could afford. And I thought, I definitely want to do it in a biplane down to Australia, open cockpit by myself, which is why it became Solo to Darwin. And the Darwin bit, if we're really being truthful about it, I couldn't afford Australia on the actual banner and it was too big for the aeroplane. So that's why it became Solo to Darwin.
I love you, Amanda. You tell it straight. Okay, so you go out, you get yourself a Tiger Moth. Tell us about it. Tell us about the aircraft.
Oh, excellent. Beautiful, yes. So I'm flying all around, doing all these different aeroplanes and flying them. And of course, you start to be in the Moth world, and therefore you hear about all these ones that are for sale. So I bought the Moth world. I bought a Tiger Moth. She needed quite a bit of work doing to it, as all Tiger Moths do. But now she's absolutely beautiful. And I fitted the long-range tank. And the long-range tank is really funny because that long-range tank has actually been to Australia twice. With David's sister.
Right.
And I had to have that long-range tank because now, of course, you have to have paperwork to do this kind of stuff. So when Amy got in, she didn't need paperwork. Now, I'm not taking anything away from Amy because she didn't have any kind of weather, you know, forecasting or anything like that or GPS.
Yeah.
Whereas I have GPS and weather, but Amy didn't have to worry about airspace or radios or anything like paperwork. Or too much paperwork. So the aeroplane had to be, I had to have it on C of A rather than permit. Well, you can take it on permit, but it's more difficult. And things like a long-range tank in a Tiger Moth is quite unusual. So therefore, I had to have paperwork for it. And I knew that this tank was in existence. So I went around all these people that had been to Australia and got all their good knowledge about it and bought this tank. And it had the piece of paper, which the CA was very happy with. And I won't tell them that I patched it together. So the tank that was in there, I decided to put on brakes and a tailwheel. Amy had a skid. David's sister went down with a skid, which is what the Tiger actually has. It has a metal skid. And I decided not to do that because I was going to be taxiing on lots of long runways and lots of long taxiways because you've got to land at customs airports. So instead of all the polo fields that Amy landed in. So that was one of the things I changed. I also changed the fact of the fuel pump. So getting me fuel from the extra tank, I had three tanks, so two extra tanks, and then pumping that up to the top tank because it's gravity fed into the engine. I decided she had what they call a wobble pump. So she just literally pushed it backwards and forwards with her arm all the time, all the way to Australia. And this would then produce leaks and all kinds of stuff. And I thought, no way. And I'd flown one Tiger with that. And I thought, I cannot do that all the way to Australia. So I had an engine-driven fuel pump. And I thought, great. And Matt, the engineer, he fitted this wonderful left-right tank, which was basically the forward tank and the next forward tank. And I thought this was from a Spitfire. So I was telling people, I've got a Spitfire fuel tank change in my cockpit of Accent. See, this is lovely. And he turned around and he went, no, I got that out of a PA-28. Oh, great. Thanks very much. So she's got a few little bits of extra things. But apart from that, she's
a standard.
Tiger Moth. She's done but the big tank fix in the front. So I took the seat out and took all the front cockpit out, the front instruments out, and the big tank fits in that like a person. And then I put a cover on it. So there's just me and all this fuel.
Right. Okay. Is there any reason, this is a bit of a naive question, but is there any reason you couldn't have sat in the front?
C of G, very simple.
Right.
So it's the C of G of where the aeroplane tips when it's taking off and landing. So you have to sit in the back when you're solo. But and the fuel is easier than to pump up from that into the tank. So I see where your question is going because you've got all the fuel in the front. But I'm going to be using that fuel, so therefore that weight is actually going to be disappearing. So therefore, you still haven't got it. So you need the person who likes the cakes in the back. That's the center of gravity in the right place.
Right. Okay. So how does then, let me ask you, does the planning or does the route come first? Because Amy just said, I'm going to go straight line. What did you do? Did you have to start planning it, or did you say, what I'm going to do is? How did that work for you?
I haven't been asked that question. That's a really good question. Yeah, Amy just drew a line on the chart and went for it. And of course, again, no airspace. And she didn't have to worry about where she was going to land. She could land in polar fields and fields anywhere. So I got her line on the chart and then amalgamated where I could fly that would be the easiest to sort of emulate that route. And again, cutting out Syria, Iran and Iraq and sort of going round the other way, which is why I ended up flying across the Mediterranean, which Amy didn't. She just went straight over land. So it was, they kind of go together because you sort of go, right, this is where I want to fly, and then plan it a bit, and then that doesn't work. So you then have to look again at where you want to fly and then replan it. And you end up replanning it, you know, I don't know, I probably replanned it about 30 times over all the, from the first time when I sat down and started doing it, you then, because some places don't have AVGAS, some places don't have the customs, all that kind of boring stuff. So you then had new permissions, and you can't fly from Turkey to Cyprus, and you can't fly, you know, so all of those things have got to be figured out somehow. So you have to. Yeah.
So what was the planned route?
The planned route?
Out of the UK. By the way, did you start in the same place?
I couldn't. She started in Croydon, and Croydon is no longer an airport, so I couldn't actually start.
At Croydon.
But what I did was the night before I flew from Biggin Hill, and the day before I flew over Croydon, but Croydon is further west. And I figured out I wouldn't have enough fuel to fly over Croydon and then come back. So I did it the day before as my little nod to Amy. Flew over Croydon, then landed at Biggin Hill, and then took off and flew from there. Yeah, so I was going to fly down through Vienna, down to Turkey. I went through Romania, which was amazing, which again wasn't where Amy was. She flew down the bottom. And the reason why I went to Romania is because I knew somebody from there, and they invited me to a food festival, and I'm somebody that likes food. And for a while I said, no, I'm not going to go there because I've got to fly through the Carpathian Mountains and they're up to 10,000 feet. And then they said, no, it's fine. Don't worry. There's a little pass through it, and the flying club will escort you through the pass, which is where the picture on the back of the book comes from. So this is the Alt Pass through the Carpathian Mountains. And again, Amy didn't go through that. And this is where adventures become new and become amazing, because I'm probably the only person that's flown a tiger moth through that particular pass. And this was down through the Carpathian Mountains, past Dracula's castle, which I was telling to a load of school kids the one day. And I normally do 7 years and up, and this was 7 years and down. And I'm going, so I had to be really careful because I'm flying past Dracula's castle, but it's okay because I'm flying past it through the daytime. And they're kind of like, excuse me, miss, what's Dracula?
All right. Times have changed.
Yeah, so that was a different, and that was amazing because they flew down with me, and it was just, and that flight will stay with me forever because, you know, there was snow-capped mountains on the one side. There was all these beautiful fir tree-covered mountains on the other. And you're literally following a river down the bottom. You're not doing any GPS points, nothing like that. You're following a river. And it's those kind of stuff is great. And then, of course, so the original route, she would have gone through Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, down through India, down through all of Malaysia, and down through to Australia. I was going to have to come round a little bit through Beirut, and then come through Kuwait and go along that way, and then up into Pakistan, India, and then follow Malaysia and go down. And then I could sort of keep better to Amy's route after that. It's the Middle Eastern bit, which now, of course, you know, for replanning, will have to be even more replanned.
Did you know that during the Falklands War in 1982, there was a plan to put the Black Buck raids on steroids, by sending an Avro Vulcan to bomb airfield targets on mainland Argentina, potentially returning to RAF Waddington the long way round, via Chile, Easter Island, Tahiti, Hawaii, the USA and Canada? Did you also know that during the Second World War, a proposal was made to build B-29 superfortresses in the UK, powered by Bristol Centaurus engines? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
Could you have done it all in... Was it planned to do in 40 days?
Yes,
it was
planned to do in 40 days.
Yeah. We're going to come back to some of the the stick in the spokes or the prop or the the brakes or...
Yeah. It was planned to do in 40 days, which I thought was going to be a little bit of a tough ask with weather and tiger moths and everything. But I thought, you know what, you've got to stick your mark in the sand and go, that's what I'm going to go for, rather than go, well, and I knew things would go wrong. So you end up staying a little bit longer there and a little bit longer there. But I thought, right, let's go for it. And it'll be a movable feast as I go down.
Okay. And let me drag you all the way back to day one. It was quite a send-off.
Yes, it was. It was a bit like the film. So the film is beginning to sort of be the premiere of the film. I'm organising all of that and inviting everybody. And the going away party, I just thought I'd just set off, get in my airplane and go. And everybody go, well, we've got to come and say goodbye and all the rest of it. And because it's at Biggin Hill, which is a commercial airport, you had to again have permission and everything. So yeah. There ended up lots of people there, which was really lovely and it was absolutely fantastic. And of course, there was my mum there. And not my dad, because my dad was no longer there. There's a lovely bit, you'll see me in the film, I say to my mum, I promise I will come back. And I'm getting emotional now. And I said, I promise I will come back. And dad hadn't been that long departed. And my mum had moved house. And apparently she watched me fly off. She was fine up until that point, and then she watched me disappear. And she thought, oh, I'm never going to see her again.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of understandable when you're a parent. I don't think you ever let go of those things. But you got off, you got into the journey, obviously started heading easterly. And the early stages weren't too challenging. But something that comes up in the book a couple of times that I just loved, and I've got to ask you it now. The answer in German is no.
Yes, no. The answer in German is no. I love my Germanic friends. Yes, the answer is always no, and then it starts to be maybe, and then it turns to yes. And this is, it's really weird. Even for a glass of water, no.
It's
very funny. So a lot of the, the oil and the permissions. So I sent what I thought, I tried to do an awful lot of this stuff over email these days. So you think that's great. So I've asked for the oil. I've told them what kind of oil I need and what I need tie downs and I need hangar space and all this lot. And then when you arrive, it's kind of like, oh, no, I haven't spoken to that person. And no, we don't have oil. And no, we don't have tie downs. And no, you can't possibly park here. So a lot of the answer is no at the thing. And it's just their culture. It's their kind of culture. It was, and of course, I had to divert on the very first day.
Yeah.
So I didn't even make it to my first landing point, which was Mannheim. Amy had landed at Vienna because she had a much bigger tank than me. So she, because her airplane, the Gypsy Moth, is slightly bigger, so she took a bigger fuel tank.
And she was going to make that in one hop?
She made that in one hop, yeah.
Wow,
Yeah, so it was like 7 hours.
That's quite amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. It was just, unbelievable. The amount of hours that she actually flew for was just amazing. Yeah. Yeah. So I ended up in Saarbrücken, which was lovely. And they were really nice to me. But then the next morning, they were kind of like, who are you? What are you? No, you can't come in here.
And I think that is, I think one of the things from the book and talking to you and knowing you a little bit, I think the thing that comes through are the people, yeah, you know, of all shapes, sizes, colours, creeds and so forth. Some of the people you met were just simply quite amazing.
Oh, stunning. I hadn't banked on that at all. And I don't know why, because when I read Amy's book and I've been rereading it, and of course she met amazing people who helped her and I met amazing people who helped me. And I hadn't really banked on that at all. You know, you get so wrapped up in it. And as I say, I'd been recovering from breast cancer and I got my medical back and flying and my dad, you know, dying. Mm. So, and my mum moving, and you get wrapped up so in life, and then you set off on something like this and you land. And you think, oh, that's fine, I'll just pack my airplane away. And you forget how beautiful a Tiger Moth is, you know, this beautiful biplane that looks absolutely, yeah, gorgeous. Of course people want to look at it. Of course people want to ask you what it is. And I'd stuck my route in the baggage compartment at the back because I thought, well, that'll be simple. I can show people that.
Yeah.
But of course, I had all my baggage in the back of it, so I was trying to get that out. But, yeah, I hadn't banked on amazing people that I met. And the countries that have more challenging or have more challenges in them, the countries like, yeah, Romania, like Cyprus, like Beirut, the people there are unbelievably generous.
Yeah.
And I met such amazing people. Huda in Beirut, who is one of the first commercial lady pilots there, who does, yeah, the pleasure flights in the 172. And she's now got into the airlines, I see on her Facebook. And she was just, she just sort of like wanted to wrap me up and take me home, you know, and sort of look after me. And,
yeah,
and they were just, honestly, I was fed and watered and entertained, and people were so generous and so kind.
Yeah.
And that's what gets to you. And you think, wow, yeah. And if you've made, you know, I hopefully made a little difference to the little girl. You read about the girl,
yeah,
who's dyslexia in Sibiu. And again, because I've been saying all of this on Facebook, apparently she's in big school now, and she gave me her little drawing of me in the Tiger Moth with my,
yeah,
with my hair all over the place and my goggles and that lot. And her mum had sort of contacted me and said, can she meet me? Because she wanted to sort of, she was struggling because she was dyslexic, and at school she wanted to, you know, meet somebody who was being, mm, okay with dyslexia. And she was just lovely. And I still have that picture now. And I just... And she inspired me to really sort of say, you know, excuse me. And she really inspired me to sort of say, yes, I am dyslexic, and yes, you can do stuff. And I really am just an ordinary person who did an extraordinary thing. And I am just persistence. Mm. I really am just persistence.
Now, I don't know how to ask you this because you don't know any other way of doing it. But how challenging having and being dyslexic? Was it for you in things like the planning and the communications and the immediacy of some of the challenges that you had? Can you just talk us through how you did that? Because it, in itself, you're quite inspiring, not only being a female pilot, taking on a challenge like this, but also because you're dyslexic. Can't even get it out.
I think you might be dyslexic because if you can't say it and you can't spell then you're probably dyslexic, KO.
I think there's a strong possibility I'm on there somewhere.
Oh, well, I was talking to somebody today. I flew somebody in the Tiger Moth today, and he helps adults with learning disabilities. And I said, you know, we need all spectrums to make a light, all spectrums of light to make a rainbow. And it's that, yeah, kind of thing. We do need all this. And yes, being dyslexic is challenging. You know, checklists, permissions, emailing, trying to find a thread of emailing and stuff and spreadsheets. Oh, you know, I'd rather have my airplane on fire. I'd rather have another engine failure, thank you very much, than do a spreadsheet. So it is difficult because my brain doesn't work in those kind of areas very well. It works in pictures and charts and it works in communication. I'm very good at oral communication, but written communication is not very good. So, yes, it takes me a lot longer. It takes me about 50% longer to do all the emailing communications. So that was quite difficult. And, you know, suddenly in Turkey, I had to fill in a flight I had to fill in the all the gender and everything and put it as a fax machine. And I was kind of like,
wow.
What's a fax machine? I was kind of like, I haven't done one of them in years. So I was trying to figure it out, and I was trying to sort of find something to find, you know, because you've got to do it by letters, you know, and all this kind of thing.
Yeah, of course. So
it's stuff like that that tends to be a little bit tricky and just takes me longer. So,
let's just remind everyone, you were on your own as well.
Yes.
Didn't have anyone flying with you, and you didn't have a support plane either, did you?
No. Wherever I landed, they go, "Where's your support plane?" And I go, "Here she is. It's Aksan."
Yeah.
"Here she is." No, I was completely solo, which is why it was solo to Darwin. And the reason why you saw the flying through the Alt Pass is when that fantastic, where all the flight club got everything out, and you'll see it in the documentary, they get all their little airplanes out and we all set off flying, and it's absolutely fantastic. And that was the only bit of footage that I got through the whole of the trip. So there's a big fuel tank in the front, so it is just me, and wherever I landed it was just me. And that was quite intense, because you're flying along for hours by yourself, and you're figuring out radio, you're figuring out, you know, flying the airplane. It was quite physically quite difficult to fly a lot of the time, and you're sorting out negotiations over the radio to land, and then suddenly you've had all this time by yourself, and suddenly there's all these people around you that are asking all these questions, and you're kind of like, and you feel like going, "Well, you just leave me alone."
You're tired, you're hungry.
You're tired, you want the toilet, all this.
All those practical things.
But it was completely solo. I had help, of course, when I had the engine failures to fix the airplane. So then the engineers would come out and help me. But apart from that, it was just little me.
So let's talk about the engine failures. Let's talk about flying across the Mediterranean, goodness me, in a single engine aircraft. And how old is she again?
She was 1942. So when we did, now I've got to work it out, haven't I?
Don't worry. let's blame the dyslexia and I'm on the spectrum. She's pretty old. 90 years old.
Flying over the Mediterranean. I mean, yes. And of course, you know, you're going to have problems with an 80-year-old airplane. So I knew I was going to have engine problems with her at some point. I didn't think I was going to have quite as many and quite as soon. So that's why I've been learning more of the engineering side over this last winter. So when I attempt it again, I'm going to have much more skills. I'm going to have better skills to know what's wrong with her, rather than going, "Oh, she's making a funny noise."
Yeah.
And also I can do more of the maintenance. Amy did quite a lot of maintenance every single night. She changed the plugs. She did a lot more oil changes, that kind of stuff. And I think actually that would help. And right. I've been learning how to do all of that. But yeah, flying across water's never bothered me. I took a life raft instead of a parachute, though, because I'm not a very good swimmer. And I remember reaching up.
I'm not a great swimmer, but
you ditch next to a nice big cruise liner, you see, and they'll all just wave at you as they go by. But I took the life raft, and I phoned them up, because you rent things, or I rent things.
Yeah.
And I phoned them up, and I said, "Can I sit on the life raft?" And they went, "We've never had that question." And I explained them why, and we're kind of like, that's a bit weird. And it was so uncomfortable that I did actually rub a hole in my trousers, because I kept having to sort of move and things. But yeah,
quite a weight, isn't it? That's quite a weight to carry.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I thought, there's no point putting it in the back, in the baggage compartment, because if I have to ditch, I'm not sure I'll be able to just swim around and get it out. So I actually, I took most of the seat out where I was, because you normally have a wooden seat in there. And I thought, well, that's no good. And people have put tools under and things like that. And I thought, no, I'm going to get rid of all of that. And I'm going to sit on the life raft. I had a layer of tools underneath the life raft. Then I had the life raft. And then I had my clothes basically packed on the top of that. And that's what I made my sort of cushions with, if you are. So, so if I did have to ditch in the Mediterranean, at least I'd have the life raft. But I thought I went over the top, because when we were chatting to them, they managed to convince me to buy some shark repellent. And then when I was looking at the shark repellent, I thought, the chips are going to be really down, aren't they, if I have to use the shark repellent? I think that was my favourite thing that I took as a security.
yeah. And, you know, we're not going to take too much away from the book or the film. But was there a reason that the engine played up quite as much as it did in the end?
I think it was because it was old and I'd bought it secondhand. And, yeah, it probably hadn't had the best life from the engineer beforehand. So I think it was just too old.
Yeah.
And one of the real reasons as well is it was the coldest winter. It was the coldest May in 50 years, it worked out. So I'd been flying it near freezing, not taking my thermals with me. And then I went from flying several days in near freezing conditions down through Turkey into Greece. And then it was plus 40. So the engine went from freezing to 40 within the space of 12 hours.
Yeah.
And they really don't like that. So I think that finished it off on the first
one. Right.
So yes. So I'm saving up my pennies to get reconditioned. You can't get new ones, of course.
Yeah.
You can buy more reconditioned, sort of better engines than that. Yeah.
Okay. And how does one, just a practical question, flying all through all those different countries, regions, and parts of the world? I suppose a credit card works wonders. But it's a mighty expensive adventure, this. Who was supporting you on this other than your savings?
Me.
No one?
And don't tell me, Mum. She's got to find out in the film.
Lucky she doesn't listen to Extended then.
Yeah. She's going to watch the film, though. This might be bad. Yeah, it was me. I mean, I'd saved up 15 years. I'd thrown everything at it.
Yeah.
Holidays, no, you know. I just saved and saved and saved and just went for it. And it just, you know, and tried to do my best as I could. So I was staying in very bargain basement sort of places.
Yeah.
And I haven't, you know, if you take a lifetime of sort of £2,000 holidays for 15 years.
Yeah,
Don't do that. Then that's basically the trip. It's stuff like that I sacrificed an awful lot. And I suppose that in some ways that's why people wouldn't do it, because people wouldn't want to sacrifice what they want to do.
Yeah. But everyone wants to do something a bit different, but you got a bit of a spanner in the works, as the saying goes. We won't talk through too much about it because we want people to read and the book as well. But How does one deal with something as catastrophic as an engine failure?
You're trained, aren't you, as a pilot? You're trained as a pilot, and there's a funny moment in the film. You watch it that I'm there going, please not again at Rhodes, please not again at Rhodes. But yeah, you're trained as a pilot to do it, but I really as I have to turn round and face the water, that's the moment that I realised I was probably going in the drink. And that's so the life raft, you know, was worth the effort.
Was worth the investment.
Let's leave it at that. And then, as I say, they'll have to watch the thing. And this is it. So the film is coming out, the film premiere. It's going to be shown at the RAF Club, which is fantastic. The tickets are out there. They've got early bird tickets. And what I've done is, if you buy the book and the film and a ticket for the film, then you get entered into the golden ticket grand prize, where you can win a flight with me, lunch with me. You get to talk to me even more than just on Extended. Gee, would you really want to have that? Maybe there's a ticket to shut me up. So I've done that. And now rebuilding Aksan. So all of that is.
Let me just finish the story, though, because one of the things that fascinates me is you weren't an engineer, but one of the things you hadn't planned for, apart from postponing the remainder of the trip because of some of these issues, is you had to, in effect, take her apart and box her up and send her home. That wasn't quite as easy as it sounds, was it?
No. So after all the engine failures, I then had to make the decision to ship her home. And taking her apart was even emotionally difficult, but physically difficult as well, because we were at an airport that didn't have a hangar. So it was outside. So poor Matt was getting sunburnt again, the engineer. And just, again, the politics are very difficult. And the culture in that particular country was, oh, don't worry about it. We have 15 minutes. We're going to have a coffee and we'll just relax. And the 15 minutes would turn into a strike that would last, you know, 3 days. And you're kind of like, oh.
Yeah.
So a lot of that kind of stuff was very difficult. And it was incredibly difficult to sort of put her into a box and then bring my poor accent home. But then there's going to be a twist at the end of all of this because I'm now rebuilding her. So, the next twist after, which will be at the end of the end of the film. And you okay. have to read the end of the book to find out the next twist.
So we won't cross that one. But she's back. And you've been back. We've talked a little bit about what you've done, but she's currently in the workshop, isn't she?
She's currently in the workshop. She's currently in rebuild. And I have, as I say, over this last winter, I've been learning more about how to rebuild her. So she's currently in rebuild and being put back together in a better, how would you say, sort of, yeah, so I'm rebuilding her into much better condition.
Yeah, to a better spec. And,
yeah.
And does that in some ways, Amanda, does that give you a bit more confidence in flying her? I know we've got to get to that. She has to be rebuilt and so forth. But is there something about seeing the insides of her, making sure it's done to a very strong specification, seeing it being done properly, in some instances doing it yourself? For me, that'd frighten the bejesus out of me, that's for sure, because I can't trust myself to do anything like that. But no, but does that make you feel a bit more confident that when she is back together, she'll be in such a better place than where she was? Probably the best way of saying it.
Yes, I'm getting much more confident on learning how it's a simple aeroplane and it's a simple engine, but it's not easy, which is about anything in life. You know, dyslexia is simple, but it's not easy. It's getting to everything at it. So what it's taken out is a lot of the fear of actually taking a cylinder apart. You know, I can now take a cylinder apart, not very gracefully and not, you know, very well, but I can actually do stuff like that. So I can help myself a lot more when I'm down route, because I'm still going to have problems. She's still going to, you know, blow a cylinder head. Or everybody who's taken a Tiger Moth down to Australia has blown a cylinder head. So I knew that was going to happen. But now I have much more ability to know what is actually going on in that aeroplane. And like you say, and I've been learning so much more about it and understanding her more and understanding, you know, that the oil and all that kind of stuff, and like you say, getting much more au fait with it and trusting myself much better with it. So I'm really enjoying that. And of course my dad was an engineer. Did I press something wrong? My dad was an engineer, and he'd be thrilled that I was learning more about it. And Amy, of course, was the first female aeronautical ground engineer in this country. So I'm paying even more homage to them. And I think it just helps you know, and more about how she is put together and the flying side of it and all that kind of thing.
And will you have some sort of qualification as a result of this exercise?
Oh, that'll be a long time in the future, if and when. And it's
purely practical. It's not
purely
academic.
Practical at the moment. Yeah. Just to help me for the actual trip. The actual qualifications, of course, I've got to take more exams and all that kind of things. And at the moment, I'm kind of like, no, I'm not thinking about that. But never say never.
You have done it all. So what's your what's your most exciting memory of the trip?
Oh, the Alt Pass. Yeah, that you know, flying down. As I say, the Carpathian Mountains were amazing. Just that snow-capped mountains one side, and we were weaving in and out, following that river, and they with them formating around me and flying with me, and me waving at them. That was just I just relive that a lot of the time, and it just beautiful. And I think that was really one of them. The other one was, of course, just going over the channel.
So yeah,
literally diving under the clouds. I thought I'd have to divert right at the start, and diving under the clouds and then breaking out over the white cliffs, looking behind me at the white cliffs and going over the channel and clearing my goggles of the rain. And then realizing that actually I'm doing this. And then I think that was mixed with sheer terror of I'm actually doing this.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So we've talked briefly about the film. We've talked very, very briefly about the book. It is, of course, Solo to Darwin, in the footsteps of Amy Johnson. It's published by Grub Street. This will be out before the film gets released. For those who are excited enough to come along and see the premiere with you at the RAF Club in London, when is it? How can they get tickets? And how can they get a hold of a book?
So the book is out on Amazon now, pre-order. So you can order that straight from Amazon. It'll be on the D-Day air show at Duxford, and I'll be on several air shows all around England. So you can come and buy one on any of the stands there and the Aviation Bookshop. The film, at the RAF Club, all of those tickets will be available on my website, which is amandajharrison.com. That's amandajharrison.com. All the information about either the book and the film will be on that. And right. one last thing about the book, I have to say, I'm absolutely thrilled to bits because Polly Vasher wrote my foreword.
I was going to say that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I helped her with a bit of her planning when she was flying around England and one of her round the world trips. And she's been such a strength and supporter of mine. And I think she's just this amazing lady. And she, of course, has flown around the world twice. And then all around England. And it was Grub Street that asked her to do it. And I get emotional about that. And she's such my hero. And I can't believe, I mean, this is little me. How wonderful is this? She's written my foreword. So I'm really thrilled with that. And thank you very much, Polly.
There's wonderful words in there. You should be very proud of that. There's no little me. We're all really, really proud of you as well. So Amanda, thanks so much for coming in to give us a bit of an exclusive on what's to come. We wish you all the very best for the book release and the film premiere.
Thank you very much, Peter. Thank you.
So that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Mick Oakey at The Aviation Historian, and of course, Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiast Book Club and Andy Wright at Aircrew Book Review. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Ellie, Gareth and Tim on the extended Twitter, Facebook, Threads and Instagram feeds. Just before we go, Amanda, where can we find you on social media?
I'm normally on Facebook and Instagram. And again, that's all on the website. And if you put in Amanda Harrison Pilot, I'll come up on both of those.
Right. That's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Amanda.
Thank you.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended. is XTP Media.